Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
So, Fry, who would want to read a memoir of someone who grew up in the privileged California community of Palos Verdes, a suburban story? Yeah. I mean, who would want to read that? Everyone will want to read The Black Girl Next Door from our next guest. The author, Jennifer Bazile, joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. First of all, Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
You know, this is a story that I want to just frame a little bit. There were Supreme Court decisions in the 1950s. Of course, the history of civil rights goes way, way back in America. But if we start in the 60s with the Supreme Court decisions, the congressional acts that created the civil rights laws and the voting rights laws, then parents and families made decisions in the 60s and 70s to actually live in an integrated way, and parents moved into neighborhoods all around the United States. But the implications of integration were lived by young girls like you on the streets of places like Palos Verdes, where you are the one black person in the neighborhood, right?
That's right.
And through your eyes, what was that like? And I'm drawn to the fight on the playground that really is a scene that I still get chills just thinking back to reading. I've read it twice or three times now.
Well, thank you so much. You know, here's the thing. When we think about history, we often think about the big ceremonial events, the rituals, the court decisions, the pictures that we saw on the evening news. But history for all of us unfolds every day. And I learned, I had my racial education just like the people of my generation. We got our racial education on the playground, at the soccer field, at the dinner table. That's where it happened for us. And the history of integration in this country really is the history of childhood. So, for example, the picture you talk about was taken the picture on the cover of the book is the picture that was taken on the day that I took my second grade picture. And on that day, after my mom had spent hours doing my hair, three white boys in my class who had been bothering me decided that that was the day that we were going to have a fight. So, that's kind of how it happened, and I won't spoil what happens. I'm okay now. The boys are probably okay now, but they weren't that day. And, that's where it happened for me. That's what unfolded.
Jennifer, who were you fighting for? Were you fighting for you, or were you fighting for your parents' decision, or were you fighting for all of Black America?
You know, I didn't really have a concept of what all of Black America was at 7 years old, but I did know that I was fighting for myself and for my parents. And what I came to discover later was I was fighting for all of those relatives of mine and all those family members whom segregation had prevented from living in places like this beautiful seaside suburb where I was growing up.
You know, it strikes me that sometimes the little things are the ones, or things that are little to other people may be large in our life. And you mention your hair in the context of this great fight scene and story. And I say great in the sense of, you know, great battle scene in a movie. It's not pretty. But you also talk about your hair. My hair grew out of my head, but it did not belong to me. Black girls did never wash our own hair. Our mothers did. Choose my own hairstyle, never. With Mickey O, as I like to call her, as the first lady, a lot of people are just catching up on the black train, on the hair train. What did you learn as a kid?
Well, you know, I learned that hair told a very powerful and important story about not just me, but my whole family. And my white friends carried brushes and combs to school. And if you're an African-American girl, if you're a woman of African descent, you know, when you were a girl, you didn't carry a brush or comb to school. Your parents thought of a hairbrush or comb as a weapon. And so this is one of the ways in which I figured out early on how different I was. It was a way that I experienced my own isolation. Another similar kind of example is the makeup counter. Going to get a beauty makeover with a girlfriend of mine, she was white, and there was no makeup at the counter for me. It's the small ways, you're absolutely right, Farai, that you learn about whether or not you fit in or you don't, and how that works.
Well, this idea that history is experienced by kids, you know, I'm reminded of going to a 90% black junior high in Syracuse, New York, and being the only white kid in my class. And because I was taller than all the other white kids in the school, I kept getting into fights because people would come up to me and say, how come you're so tall?
Exactly.
And on the playground, I have to defend this, and it was so much like living the history that you'd see in the papers every day.
You know, and that's exactly right. And here's the thing. Integration, the history of integration, which we don't talk about in this country very much, isn't just the history of black people. It's the history of white people, too. It is the history of kids, because it was in schools that so much of this unfolded for all of us.
Now, I suspect if I say page 168, you may know what I'm talking about here. Your father said something to you when you guys, I believe, were on a cruise.
Yes.
And he said something. I want you to give us the context for what he said here.
Well, go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah, the quote is, "I'm telling you right now," your father said, and he was angry for something that had happened. "I'm not raising you two for some white man."
Yes.
What was going on there? We got about 2 minutes. I don't want to miss this story,
okay,
but I want to let you rip on it.
So here we go. We are on this cruise. I'm in seventh grade. I'm about 12 years old. Everything looks great. I think that this is going to be my love boat moment. The cruise looks very much like our community. It's overwhelmingly white. And one morning after we wake up, my sister and I go to breakfast, and my dad says to us when we get back to the cabin, "You've been talking to all the white kids on the ship, but you don't know anything about the black ones." And my parents completely freaked out. They said, "You have to learn the names of all the black kids on this ship by the end of the day, or you don't get your cabin keys back." They kicked us out, and as we were leaving, my dad said, "I'm not raising you for a white man."
Wow.
You know, this is another one of those places, dating and friendship, where we learned about what being black was actually going to mean, not just to white people, but to ourselves.
Now, I was trying to explain to someone the other day how there's the whole stereotype of the black single mother, but there's also this path that a lot of black career women get on where no one is good enough. Working class black men aren't good enough. White guys aren't good enough, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How do you think that your book could help inform the next generation of black womanhood?
Well, you know, part of the thing that I say in this book is every woman's life begins in girlhood. And so many of these defining experiences happen to us when we have the least control over our lives. So part of the thing is for us as women to tell the story so that the next generation of women don't walk into a void of silence.
Well, the black girl next door, be sure to invite her into your home. That's the title of the book written by Jennifer Bazil, who joined us from New Haven, Connecticut. It's an extraordinary memoir of growing up as the one black child in a neighborhood of whites in upper middle class California. Jennifer, thanks so much and congratulations.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.